Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Between running my group practice, carrying my own clinical caseload, recording a weekly podcast, and facilitating and running Trauma Therapist Network, I'm pretty busy. Some might even say my life is chaotic. I'm constantly on the go, and while I do love coffee, I've been looking for something better, a simple but effective alternative that doesn't take even more time out of my day. I don't have time to do endless research and buy ingredients to try and enhance my daily coffee routine. Everyday Dose is my new coffee ritual. It's the same coffee I know and love, but it's enhanced with collagen protein, nootropics, and functional mushroom. My gut and brain have never been happier. It takes 30 seconds to make, and I never run out of the ingredients that I need. Everyday Dose is coffee plus benefits. They combine high-quality coffee with powerful ingredients like lion's mane and chaga, collagen protein, and nootropics to fuel your brain, boost focus, and give you clean, sustained energy all day long. It tastes just like coffee without the downside. No crash, no jitters, just clean, sustained energy. Right now, get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit. Free peppermint mocha creamer plus for the holidays and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/chat or use code CHAT at checkout. You've been told your health starts in your gut, but if you're a woman, it all starts with your hormones. When your hormones are off, everything's off, including digestive issues, mood, mental clarity, energy levels, weight management, and so much more. As the new year approaches, imagine hitting refresh and supporting your body with optimal hormone balance. An award-winning German nutrition scientist created a powerful herbal formula called Hormone Harmony, which combines 12 powerful adaptogens into one single capsule. Each of these ingredients is carefully selected based on scientific evidence and has been proven effective in clinical studies for women of various ages and hormonal profiles, so you can feel your best this holiday season. Happy Mammoth, the company behind this phenomenal formula, has helped over 2.4 million women get their lives back and feel like themselves again after years or even decades of hormonal imbalances. What makes this formula unlike anything else on the market is that it tackles multiple hormone imbalances at the same time, creating a cascade of benefits all throughout the body and mind, leading to better mood, more energy, and deep comfort. You can try Hormone Harmony risk-free and get a 15% off your first order with code CHAT at checkout.
Therapists, ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 509.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm bringing you a replay of a conversation about EMDR. I talked with my friend Roten Breyer before I was trained in EMDR about how EMDR can be a deeply meaningful therapeutic method. People can learn things about themselves that they didn't understand, heal deep wounds, even developmental trauma. And there's so much potential for what can happen through EMDR. And some people say that it's too protocol-based, too driven by the structure of following the 8 steps. Rotem wrote a book called The Art and Science of EMDR, and he's talking about how to bring more of the heart into the work when you're using EMDR as a therapist. So we had a really fun conversation about that. And I put that together with another previous interview I did with Rotem, where he talked about using psychedelics and EMDR together in therapy. So that is another really different way of working with EMDR to bring together psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy and the EMDR 8-phase protocol. So I put these two episodes together so that you can think about being creative as an EMDR therapist, or if you're a person who's considering EMDR therapy, or maybe hasn't had the experience with EMDR that you were looking for, to help you understand that there are many different ways to use this method while keeping fidelity to the model. So I hope this conversation, or these two conversations with Rotem Breyer, will be interesting and thought-provoking for you. And I'd love to hear what you think. Thank you, as always, for listening to Therapy Chat. We value your ratings and reviews. So if you listen on your favorite podcast platform and you want to let everyone know how much you love Therapy Chat, that would be very welcome, because it helps more people find it. So as we come toward the end of 2025, I just want to let you know that I really appreciate you. Thank you so much for listening. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm so excited to be speaking with Rotem Breyer, the author of The Art and Science of EMDR. Rotem, thank you so much for being my guest today on Therapy Chat.
Thanks for having me, Laura. Excited to be with you.
Yeah, I'm excited too. I was really immediately drawn to your book, and I must tell everyone that the person who helped us get connected with each other is Dr. Jamie Marich, who called herself a friend of yours. And obviously, Jamie respects you greatly. So I was instantly interested in speaking with you. And then the title of your book really drew me into the art and science of EMDR. So before we get to talking about your book, can we start off with you just telling our audience a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I am an EMDR therapist and a consultant. I am the co-founder of EMDR Denver, which is a practice in Denver that focuses on our approach is EMDR first. So it's not that we're only EMDRing our clients, you know, we are both therapists, but we are our approach from, you know, from the moment we conceptualize clients' issues, it's with the framework of EMDR. And we just found that EMDR is a very, very effective method to treat our clients. I'm always excited about learning and talking with other EMDR clinicians. I started the EMDR Learning Community, which is a community for trained EMDR therapists. If people are in training, we're letting them in. And it's really exciting to be in a community. I know, Laura, you have your own community, and it's really excited to be with fellow, you know, clinicians who are excited about the work, excited about learning, and always growing as clinicians.
I agree. It's, you know, trauma work is specialized work, and it really takes kind of a specialized perspective. You need to really love the work and believe in it and believe right. That healing is possible, and know that, you know, people who have been through the worst things can come out on the other side with not only healing, but growth as a result of that, I guess you could say, corrective experience of therapy.
Absolutely.
So Rotem, I wanted to just sort of pick up on something that you said just then, when you said we're not just EMDRing people, but we are therapists. Can you explain a little bit about what you're saying with that?
Yes, absolutely. So that takes me directly to chapter 3 of my book, which is about EMDR and the therapeutic relationship. Something that we're not talking enough about in the EMDR world. We're focusing on protocols and scripts and techniques, but the therapeutic relationships, we know from decades and decades of research that it's the number one predictor of positive therapeutic outcomes. We know that. That's, you know, regardless of what, you know, EMDR, CBT, DBT, whatever, somatic, you have to have established relationship. And this is really important. And I think that, you know, we need to talk about it more. So this is a big part of what I'm talking about in consult, big part of what I emphasize in my own, you know, treatment with clients. And I also want other EMDR therapists to be aware of that it's not just the protocol, the relationship comes first.
Yes, 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 yes. And I think in our field, what I'm observing, I certainly, when I went to grad school and I graduated in 2010 with my MSW, so 12, 13 years ago, my school was so heavily focused on evidence-based practice. We were really kind of indoctrinated that evidence-based practice is the way to go, which I agree that we want to be sure that what we're doing is therapeutically beneficial and that it's been shown to be. But I also think that really what is evidence is not always as clear cut as just what has been replicated in a randomized controlled trial. And partly that's because it's impossible to measure, or it's been difficult to measure the quality of the therapeutic relationship.
Absolutely. I'm glad you're bringing it up, because that's one of the things that I talk about in the book. How do you measure therapeutic relationships? There are some methods. I don't necessarily believe in them. There are some methods for measuring therapeutic relationship. It's very structured. You have clients fill questionnaires and beginning and end of every session. Is something that, you know, you mentioned randomized controlled trials, and one of the things I'm looking into, and this is not EMDR, but psychedelic assisted psychotherapy.
Yeah. I'm really interested in that too.
Yeah. We are getting it. I mean, this is not going away. Mm-hmm. This is here to stay. You know, you talked about healing, has a lot of healing potential. You cannot do, you know, double blind randomized controlled trial and with psychedelics. So what do? We have a gold standard, but you don't have a way to fit that in. So the point is that we don't always have to fit what we do into that structure was created for us, but we can see what actually works and we know what works. And again, that brings me back to the relationship.
Exactly. Right. And so I think this conversation will be really helpful for people who are EMDR therapists to kind of expand the way they're thinking about what should be happening in the protocols, right? So,
exactly.
You know, you do have a protocol to follow, but how do you do it? And I didn't have a chance to read your whole book, but as I was going through it, as my cat joins us, and for those who are watching this on video, we'll get a close up of him. Sorry about that. Okay. So I think I really liked one thing I saw in your book right offhand was that you're talking a lot about how to do resourcing, and you're very specifically telling people what they can do to help clients when, you know, I think that's really, really valuable.
Right, right, right. So I'm talking about, you know, in basic EMDR training, people learn, for example, the container exercise, mm-hmm. which is, you know, to simplify, put your emotions in a box. And for some people, it just doesn't work. So what I'm suggesting is to upgrade, to do it differently. The container doesn't have to be a box. It can be whatever fits your client. The idea is that you want to help the client regulate their nervous system. You want to help them be resourced, because when we get to reprocessing, it's going to be intense. So we need to teach them ways to, you know, to regulate their nervous system. And if we don't do that, your cat is cracking me up.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. So we have to do it. And it doesn't matter if the container is a box or if it's a, you know, a black hole. One of the examples I brought from one of my clients. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it functions, it does what it's supposed to do.
Right. So I think, you know, one thing you're talking about is just being more creative with it and sort of trusting yourself as a therapist to come up with the way that's going to, or maybe working together with the client to come up with the way that's going to resonate the most for them.
Right. You know, so the art and the science, right? So we're focusing on the science, but there's an art part, and the art is the right brain, right? And therapy, healing happens right brain to right brain. So if the therapist, what happens to a lot of therapists when they get trained in EMDR is that they feel like it's too rigid. They can't be themselves. And this is a myth that I'm trying to kind of break there, that you should, it's not only that you can be yourself as who you are as a client or as an individual and as a therapist, you should be yourself because this is necessary for the healing to happen.
Can you say more about that? Why is it necessary for the therapist to be themselves for healing to happen?
If you're not yourself, if you are reading a script and you're doing this and you're reading every word from the script and you're not paying attention to your client and you're not being authentic, your client will feel. I think that days of lying on a couch and there's a therapist behind you who's not saying anything, these days are gone. Even for people who do more psychodynamic psychotherapy, we bring ourselves into the therapy and our clients expect that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that when we try to be so detached, and that's what I took away from the way I was trained in school, that I'm basically what I took away was hide any parts of you that don't seem professional.
Right.
And being professional means the client cannot really feel
you. Right.
Yeah. And that's right. The opposite of what my clients find resonant in our work is that they do feel felt. And that's what helps them.
Right. Right. And I think that if you're doing that, first of all, clients will feel if my clients ask me a personal question, in most cases, unless it's, extremely personal, I'll tell them I have nothing to hide. Like, why not? Why go with that? Why would you like to know? That classic therapy response that we learned at school. Why would you like to know? Like, let's go back to you. No, I'm a person. I'm sitting here with you. And if you want to know something about it, I have nothing to hide.
Right. Because what they're really looking for there is they want to know that you can understand their struggle. They do want to know about you, but they really want to know, are you safe
for me?
Right,
exactly.
So I think it would be really valuable if you would share, we had talked about this a little bit before we started recording. Will you share a little bit about how you came to EMDR and what your learning process was like?
Yeah, so I had been a therapist for about 10 years before I got trained in EMDR. And I remember the first day of the basic training. And I remember thinking, this is why I became a therapist. All the stuff that I've done all these years, that was like a preparation. That was kind of like a foreplay for what is going to happen, to start happening now. And I really have been dedicating myself to studying this method. And it's not just EMDR, just, to give your listeners the full picture. It's a lot of integrations. It's integration with parts work, modalities, whatever you want to call it, IFS or ego state therapy, somatic, a lot of somatic work, our deeper emotions, especially trauma, is stored in a nonverbal way. So a lot of somatic work. So I really spent a lot of time studying it. And as I studied it, I figured I'll write a book to share what I learned and give EMDR therapists a slightly different perspective. Because I feel like a lot of people, I've been talking with a lot of people, a lot of EMDR trainers and authors and consultants and therapists. And a lot of people are saying that. A lot of people agree with what I'm saying. But I didn't see it in the literature. I didn't see it in things that it's being talked about. I figured I'll write a book and share this knowledge with other EMDR therapists.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you did. And so when we were talking, you mentioned that you actually did more than one EMDR basic training.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I did. And again, that was part of my research for the book to see how it's being taught. I did my basic training with one institute. When I was consulting training, I was with another institute. And then when I became a consultant, I actually went to Florida to train with one of my favorite people, Dr. Andrew Dobo, who has a Jungian background. And I think the impression that people get when they get trained in basic EMDR training is that this is the only way that EMDR is being taught. And this is the only way to do the right way to do EMDR. And what I found in these trainings is that from the moment you start even conceptualizing the client's issues, there's some differences. There's variations in how people think about client's issues, whether if it's like going back to the earliest or more present symptoms. So there are different approaches inside EMDR, which makes sense. But I think that for people who just got trained, there is only one way to do it. And oftentimes it feels rigid.
Yeah. So do you think that there are multiple different ways that the same protocols can be conceptualized and delivered?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's all about who's the client and who's in front of you. What do they need? What are their coping skills? What do they see their issue as? We always have to think about that. It's not about what your EMDR trainer told you, what this very smart EMDR author wrote in their book. It's about the person in front of you and what they need. And that's my guiding principle always. What is the client in front of me? Who is the client in front of me and what do they need? And to give them what they need. You know, because with some clients, you can move to reprocessing after 3 or 4 sessions. And with other clients, it might take 3 or 4 months. And that's okay.
Yes, yes. I've definitely seen examples of people who went for EMDR therapy and on the second session started EMDR, where the experience didn't necessarily go the way they were hoping.
Yeah. So I have done that a few times. And in most cases, I don't, because the people who show to my office usually have complex attachment issues on top of trauma. And that requires some preparation work. One on top of my head, I can think about a client who had, I'm going to change some details here, but, you know, the client had a very stable childhood, no attachment ruptures, you know, nobody's childhood is perfect, but there were no major things. Everything was, you know, there was support in the house. And then the client had a car accident that really brought full blown post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. So we very quickly moved into a processing and we're done in 3 sessions. But this is not most of the work that we do. So
the problem is finding people who really did have a stable, supportive childhood that we often think we did until we get to therapy.
Yeah.
It was that way. I thought that. I thought, what? Yeah, my family's great. All fine, wonderful. And they are wonderful. And there was a lot of stuff.
Right, right. So we need to take these things into consideration, because if we don't, we can in some situations, like you said, you know, people went to the EMDR and started a second session. That's not good. There are some bad things that can happen as a result. And, you know, I've had multiple clients who came to me who were, you know, had bad experiences with their EMDR work. Sometimes people need to do EMDR to, you know, heal their...
Recover from
EMDR. Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen.
Yeah. I would say too, that's kind of like psychedelics. Like you can go into it with a certain intention, just really not realizing what you don't know is there. And the therapist
Absolutely.
Doesn't know either what's there. If you don't know,
right.
They may not know. But I think there are ways that therapists can learn to do a better assessment to really get a true picture.
Absolutely. And in psychedelics, you know, we talk a lot about set and setting and, you know, that it's extremely important and changes the whole the work. Yeah, maybe it's a conversation for another day.
Yes, we could go a lot into that. But I would say, I think the main thing I wanted to get across there with that point is just that even if one has had a bad experience with EMDR, it doesn't mean that EMDR is not right for you. It might mean that you need a different approach.
Right, exactly. And that's where these beautiful integrations come into play. Whether if it's, you know, sometimes you need to do some parts work to help the client relate to their wounded younger parts. Sometimes you need to do more somatic work. Sometimes you have to, you know, just have clients do their work. You know, I'm a big fan of do your own work at home. Like doing preparation work in session is really great, but it's just the beginning. And I'm talking about it in the book because there is a neurobiological reason for that. If you're not being consistent with your whatever you want to call it, calming techniques, coping skills, preparation phase, it's all the same thing. If you're not consistent with that, you're not creating or strengthening these neural networks that replace your old coping behaviors. So I provide a lot of education for my clients to help them, to help motivate them to do some of this work outside of session.
I know what you're saying there. I think that it can be easy to only make, say, 45 to 50 minutes of time for yourself per week to sit with your therapist. And that's where you do all this emotional work, but you aren't doing it outside of that because you don't feel time. You have time or you just aren't used to having that much space for yourself.
Right, right. Yeah. And I don't have time. I don't accept. If you want to do the work, you need to dedicate and you have to prioritize and, you know, time. We all have 24 hours in a day, but if you really want to work, do the work and improve your mental well-being, you have to do some of that work outside of the session.
Yeah. I think it could be a long process of preparation to begin to really believe that you are worthy of this much attention. So from your perspective, EMDR can help with trauma and attachment wounds then, huh?
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you're asking this question because a lot of people think that EMDR is only good for simple trauma, whatever that means. And the first studies, the first research that was published in the 80s was about just trauma. There was not enough research about attachment and complex trauma. And now we have a lot of attention and a lot of knowledge about how to use EMDR to help clients who have these attachment wounds, not to only fix bad things that happen, but to address the good things that didn't happen. And these are, again, I heard really prominent people in the therapy world who were trained in EMDR, but a long time ago, saying that EMDR is not relational. And I so strongly disagree with that because EMDR is very relational. And if we're missing that part, again, you know, again, talking about the relationship, if we're missing that part, we're missing a lot. We're not going to be as effective in our EMDR work.
Yeah, I it's true. I mean, there's some kind of different, almost like maybe different generations of people trained in EMDR and who they learned through, how relational it is or how much emphasis is placed on. Because I'm seeing some people advertising, I do EMDR for, they'll say like anxiety, depression, and OCD.
Yeah.
And, you know, which can be expressions of trauma. And so then, you know, are you using it with the lens that you're addressing trauma or are you using it as just a symptom reduction if you think that that's all it can be or just, I don't know.
I think that our understanding of what trauma is has broadened over the past few years, right? So again, going back to what I said a minute ago about it's not just bad things that happen, it's good things that didn't happen. That can be traumatic. Or it's not only, you know, hurricanes or earthquakes or serious assaults. It can be also if you had a third grade teacher who really, really didn't like you and nobody paid attention, like your parents didn't even notice that, and you went to school every day and you were miserable. That's trauma. That's stuck in your nervous system. That's affecting your thoughts, your emotions, and your behaviors, even if you're you know, 30 something, 40 something, or 50 something. So unless you can do a good EMDR, and then we can take care of that.
Yeah. And people can get EMDR in childhood too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So my friend Jackie Flynn, who I know.
I know Jackie.
Yeah. She is the master of EMDR with children. She teaches a lot of different kinds of integrations, right? So she's integrating a lot of EMDR and play therapy, for example, which is not my thing. I'm not working with kids, so I don't know how to do these things, but I have a lot of respect for, you know, Jackie and many others, Annie Monaco and Beckley Forrest, who are teaching, you know, how to work effectively with kids, and they're doing amazing work.
Yes. Well, thanks for those names. I'll look into the last two you just mentioned who I'm not familiar with. And I think this is very hopeful and helpful, and I'm grateful. And speaking of hopefulness, there was a point that you made about the positive experiences that didn't happen. I just wanted to see if maybe you could share something about the positive experiences that do happen and how in EMDR you can like expand those. Can you?
Yeah. So I hope I understand your question correctly. So the positive experience that did happen,
or that do happen, like in the therapeutic interventions, like where in EMDR you could have a really good feeling of safety and like let that expand.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned feeling of safety, something about the polyvagal theory and how, you know, safety and connection, right? That's clients need to feel that. And once they feel that, we see a lot of these positive experiences. So, you know, in EMDR, we have what's called the SUD scale, subjective unit of disturbance. So we're asking the client on a scale of 0 to 10, when 0 is no disturbance and 10 is the worst disturbance you can ever feel, how disturbing does the memory that we're working on feeling now? And a lot of times we'll be at 7, 8, 9, sometimes 10, and we're processing in a session, a lot of times 50-minute sessions. Some of us do some extended sessions, but a lot of times 40 minutes later, that same memory, we will ask the same question and the client will say, oh, it's a 0 or 1 or 2, which is such a different experience to think about, like a memory that triggers like 9 on a 0 to 10 scale. And then, you know, just 30, 40 minutes later, it's 0, 1 or 2. It's an amazing, it really feels like a superpower.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, this ability to help people in such a significant way is amazing. Best job in the world.
Yes, to see the relief and the, wow, this is like a new experience to feel not afraid or something. You know, that's what's really like, I think sometimes people are afraid to do EMDR because they're afraid of what they'll find. But I know that right. There can also be those kinds of experiences that are also part of it. It's not one thing.
Right.
Well, Rotem, do you have anything else that you want to share about your book or your work that we didn't get into yet? I find this like so exciting and hopeful and positive.
Yeah, it is exciting. Thanks for asking that, Laura. I think that what I'm most excited about in this book is the last chapter. The last chapter is deliberate practice, which is a method of getting better. This is deliberate practice is what experts in different fields do to become experts. You know, so athletes and musicians and, you know, pilots, they all do very different things, but they have a very systematic method to learning, and the learning involves practice. And this is what the new thing that I bring to the world of EMDR. I have, again, reviewed the research and the literature and every EMDR book out there, and nobody talks about it. And this is a method that people can use to get better at what they do. So if it's, you know, trained therapists can use it in consultations, but consultants can use it in their own consultations. Trainers can use it, because if I'm sitting at a training and I only watch PowerPoint presentation, I'm not going to get better as an EMDR therapist. Maybe I'll get a little better, maybe tiny little bit better. But if I practice what I learned, so let's say I watch a PowerPoint or I watch a video, even better, and then I try it myself, and then a trainer comes or my consultant is coming, and this is how I do my own consultations, and giving me feedback And then based on that feedback, I'm trying again and I get more feedback on the littlest things, on the very, very little thing. I keep getting feedback. That's how I'm going to get better. And I hope that EMDR therapists I know, because again, we have this community of EMDR therapists and people do want to get better. And this is a really good method to getting better at what we do. So I hope people will implement it into their consultations and trainings and learning.
Well, that makes me have another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you include in that deliberate practice idea experientially receiving EMDR as a clinician too? I mean, I know that's usually built into the training to some extent.
Yeah, I highly, highly recommend. So this is what I'm telling all my consultees the first time, that get EMDR as a client. This is the best way to learn EMDR. You can do all the courses and trainings and everything in the world, but if you're not being the client, you're not feeling it, you're not experiencing it as a client, it's all going to be theoretical. So yes, definitely get it as a client. With a training is kind of like an accelerated EMDR when you're doing a training, you know, and depending on the trainer, sometimes you're not really getting to deeper things. And I think that in order to be a better EMDR therapist, definitely get your own EMDR as a client.
Yeah. I think it's just impossible to really do therapy in an embodied way if you haven't experienced what it's like to do that kind of healing work yourself, because, yeah, you know, your blind spots, you will shy away from them just unconsciously. But if you've worked, you know what they are, then when they come up, you know what's happening, you know, and you have more of a sense of, oh, I have something else that I need to give some attention to after this session is done, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation and I'm so happy that you have written this book. So where can people find you, your book?
So if people Google The Art and Science of EMDR, they will find either the book is on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever, I don't know, Target even. Who buys books at Target? Anyway, but I started this website. I called it The Art and Science of EMDR, and I have a lot of interviews that I did with, you know, the people that I found really interesting in the EMDR world. So Jamie Marriage is there, Dr. Jamie Marriage, Dr. Ariel Schwartz, Dr. Debbie Korn.
I've interviewed both of them. I'm big fans of both of them. Well, all three that you just mentioned.
Yeah. And a lot of other people who really are, you know, have many years of experience, Dr. Andrew Dobo and Beckley Forson and Monaco that I mentioned, Jackie Flynn. So this is kind of like a free resource for EMDR therapists. And then there's the EMDR learning community, which is a closed community. It's free, but it's closed. It's not on Facebook. It's on an independent website. And every EMDR therapist, even if they're still in training, can join. And we're kind of learning together. We have a monthly theme and we have weekly challenges. We have giveaways. So we're making it fun. And we're also learning together. So we're learning from each other. And I believe that we can all learn from each other. So it doesn't matter that I'm a consultant, someone just finished their basic EMDR training yesterday, they might have an idea that I never thought about. And it happens all the time. Like every day I'm in this community, I'm learning from other members, and it's really fun to learn together.
That's beautiful. What an amazing resource. I didn't know it was a free community. That's so great.
Yeah. It's at some point I thought I considered changing the name of the community to EMDR Nerds, but I'm staying with the EMDR Learning Community.
Some people don't want to identify as a nerd. They're not ready.
I know, but we
embrace that part of themselves.
We're nerds. We're EMDR nerds and we're proud of it. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a big trauma nerd myself. So I'm not an EMDR nerd yet, but big trauma nerd. So I can embrace that too.
I love that you said not yet. So that's good, Laura.
So is your website theartandscienceofemdr.com?
No, I give it kind of like a smart ass kind of name. So it's EMD, and then the word art, the letter N, and the word science.
Okay.
The art and science.
It sounded like that when you said it, but I just thought you were saying it fast. So I'll get EMDRARTNScience.com.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Correct.
Great. Yeah. I'll put that in the show notes too for anyone who's listening and didn't quite catch that. I'll put it in the show notes and all of your other stuff too.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for having me. I love what you do. And yeah, I'm grateful to spend my Monday early afternoon with you.
Oh, thanks. I am too. I'm so grateful that we connected, and I'm excited to share this with our audience.
You know, it can be hard to eat healthy without feeling like you're giving up flavor or fun, especially during the holidays. Washington Red Raspberries are a simple and seriously delicious way to add more nutrition to your day. They're American grown, picked at peak ripeness, and frozen within hours to lock in nutrients like fiber, antioxidants, and vitamin C. And they have no added sugar, just fruit, as nature intended. They're actually one of the highest fiber berries. They're also high in antioxidant vitamin C. They have a low glycemic index with low natural sugar compared to other berries. And they're a good source of folate, which is especially important during pregnancy. Washington Red Raspberries are a perfect addition to festive salads or sparkling cocktails or mocktails at holiday events. They're great in breakfast parfaits, raspberry swirled cheesecake bites. Their bright flavor and vibrant color make every dish feel special. American-grown frozen raspberries taste fresh, juicy, and full of flavor because they're grown in nutrient-rich soil and frozen at peak ripeness. Want to discover new ways to use American frozen red raspberries and get more details on where you can grab a bag of these delicious berries? Go to redraz.org. That's redrazz.org. You'll find recipes, health tips, retail locations, and everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Look for a product of the U.S. on the bag. Iron deficiency is one of the most common nutritional gaps, affecting about 1 in 3 adults, especially women. It often shows up as fatigue, weakness, brain fog, or brittle nails. The real challenge is that most people don't realize low iron may be the cause, and when they do, traditional iron supplements often fall short. They're poorly absorbed and frequently cause stomach issues, leaving people without real relief. That's why I love Citerol from PharmaNutra. It's a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology, which helps your body absorb 3 to 4 times more iron while avoiding the common side effects of traditional iron supplements like nausea and constipation. Citerol is clinically proven, globally trusted, and convenient. You can take it anytime. It fits seamlessly into your daily routine. If you're constantly feeling wiped out and foggy, like you're running on empty no matter what you do, this might be what you've been missing. Join over 2 million people who've already discovered Citerol and found the help they needed. Head to PharmaNutra-US.com and use code CHAT for 10% off your first order of Citerol. That's PharmaNutra-US.com and promo code CHAT for 10% off today. Therapy Notes is consistently transforming the way therapists manage their practices with continuous updates designed to save money and improve efficiency. Their latest game changer, Therapy Fuel, a powerful and fully integrated suite of AI tools that streamline documentation so you can focus more on your clients. With AI features that help by generating progress notes from summaries or transcriptions, creating contact notes directly from clients' secure messages, and automated summaries of client history forms, Therapy Notes users are already reporting hours of saved time and energy. Some other recent feature improvements include automated recurring client payments, electronic secondary insurance billing, and their constantly expanding library of outcome measures. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm so happy to have a returning guest for the second time, Rotem Breyer. Rotem, thanks so much for coming back to Therapy Chat today.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
You're welcome. I'm so eager to get into this conversation that we kind of danced with talking about last time. You know, we said, oh, let's come back and do that. But the audience doesn't even know. I know they're going to love it. So what we wanted to talk about today is something new you're doing using EMDR and combining that work with psychedelic assisted therapy. So really excited to hear how you're using this and what you want people to know about it. But before we get into it, let's just start off with you telling our audience a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, so I'm Rotem. I am the author of The Art and Science of EMDR, co-founder of EMDR Denver, a practice that takes an EMDR first approach to treatment. And what we're going to talk about today that I've been doing a lot lately is combining or integrating psychedelic assisted psychotherapy and EMDR therapy. And I'm really, really excited to share that with your audience because I've been seeing results beyond what I thought would be possible in psychotherapy. And I think these two modalities are so powerful, but when you combine them together, you get more kind of like the sum is larger than the parts. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really transformative.
It's exciting. I'm really excited to hear about it. I know I always say on the show how excited I am, but I really am because, you know, one of the things, as you know, I'm not an EMDR therapist. And one of the things that I've been kind of following what's going on with psychedelics and, you know, being curious, being kind of cautious and like hopeful and also, you know, skeptical of what I'm hearing. And because some people are like, it's the greatest thing in the world. And other people are like, watch out, it's very dangerous. And, you know, I've heard Right. some clients have positive and negative experiences. But additionally, some things that we do, and I'm sure this is probably true with EMDR because I know it's true with a few other modalities I've worked with, you can have kind of a psychedelic experience without any medicine. So I can only wonder what happens when you put the two together. It's like, wow. So as soon as you said you were doing that, I was like, oh my, I need to hear, how does this work? What's it like? So, I mean, let's just start off with like, what types of medicines are you using with this? Or how are you even bringing this together?
Good question. So currently I'm only using ketamine, which is mm-hmm. the only legal way to do psychedelic assisted psychotherapy right now. I'm from Denver, Colorado, and we are, you know, the state of Colorado is very progressive when it comes to that area. So recently we legalized psilocybin mushrooms, but when it comes to psychotherapy, it's very gray still. And I don't want to mess with gray. So I'm waiting. I want to say patiently, but no, not so patiently. I'm waiting for the day in about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, that I will be able to use psilocybin in psychotherapy. And right now, the state elected a board and they're making a lot of decisions about what it's going to look like. But right now, I can use ketamine. Like many other people, I was skeptical about ketamine. It has kind of like a bad reputation, Special K. It's a, you know, club drug. But what we need to remember, Laura, about all psychedelics, and, you know, you said that some people have good and bad experiences with psychedelics, is that a lot of what happens in a session, in any, it's not even in a therapy session, but with any psychedelics, it's the set and the setting. What is the expectation? What is the therapist expecting? What does the client expect to get out of it? That's the set. And the setting is, what does it look like? Is it in an office? Is it in nature, outside? Is it done when there's risk of, you know, like a lot of people use psychedelics in you know, raves or parties when they can potentially get arrested for for having these drugs. So they have all these, you know, kind of like paranoia. And I think that the fact that we're doing it legally now with prescription, so it's a prescribed medicine, has a lot effect on a lot of positive effect on what we're doing in psychedelic assisted therapy in general and psychedelic assisted EMDR therapy that I'm going to explain a little bit in a few minutes. I think that, as always, we need to remember the therapeutic relationship. So it's really important. It has a lot to do with the set and setting to have strong therapeutic relationship. It can be really, really weird for people to take these medicines and then to sit with a complete stranger. So I'm really trying to do it with established clients that the therapeutic relationship has already been formed. And then, you know, EMDR is a great modality. It's the, you know, like I said, I have an EMDR first approach, but sometimes you hit roadblocks, sometimes you get stuck. And I think that with psychedelics, it really helps when we get stuck with certain things.
Yeah. Well, I know that it can take people beyond limitations that they may not, you know, like barriers that they may encounter when they're not using the medicine are removed. And that's kind of one of the good and bad things about it, I guess. You know, it's only bad if it feels unsafe to the person and they can't, you know, integrate.
Exactly. You know, so bad trips, for example, don't happen when you do it right. When you do it in a therapeutic setting and the clients are not afraid to go toward hard things. That's a key element. This is one of the correlations that I found with EMDR and psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. You're not trying to run away from things. You're going toward. And I think that a lot of times for people been traumatized, there's a natural inclination to run away from, even if it's not conscious, from traumatic memories or experiences. And psychedelics really help people to do that. So Francine Shapiro, who developed the EMDR, talked about dual attention. James Fadiman, who is one of the fathers, or I don't know, maybe grandfathers at this point, of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, talked about awareness of polarity, which I think are very two similar concepts when it comes to being able to look at the traumatic experience and also feel it, but also look at it, observe it, not only be in it, because you can't learn from it if you're, that's basically the definition of re-traumatization, right? Like if a client just goes back to the trauma, but we're not processing it. So this is one thing. The other thing, the other correlation that I find is that both foster the integration of neural networks in the brain. So with EMDR, and we have a lot of research in both EMDR and psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, that something happens that doesn't happen in your day-to-day life or even during regular psychotherapy. There's a lot of integration of neural networks, and that's, you know, possibly one of the things that we can explain when we look at insight, people getting insight from the work. It may be due to this integration of neural networks in the brain.
So, Rotem, would you, just for someone who's listening who's really not familiar with integration of neural networks, can you explain a little bit more about what you mean when you say that? I know this episode's going to get a lot of interest from people, so, you know, it might not just be people who have been regular listeners.
Right. So let me just say, before I explain it, sometimes looking at a visual can be really, really helpful. So if you get Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, he has these two images that were done in the UK by Carhart Harris, who's done a lot of research on psychedelics. And basically, they created a visual representation of the brain on placebo and on psilocybin mushrooms. And what you see is that there's not only more activity in the brain while people are using psychedelics, but you see these networks that usually don't fire at the same time. So there's no integration. Usually if this network is in this site, on this side of the brain, this network is on the other side of the brain, they don't talk to each other. And during a psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy or during a psychedelic experience and during EMDR, networks that usually don't fire at the same time. So when I say fire, I mean electrical activity. They start firing together. And again, that leads to a lot of insights that are not accessible in the day-to-day normal consciousness. Just to give you a little background, so Aldous Huxley was a philosopher. He wrote The Doors of Perception many years ago, I think in the 50s. And he talked about the reducing valve of consciousness. It's something that we all have, and it helps us survive in the day-to-day life, right? We can't be aware of everything. We need to focus on certain things. But it has a price too, because there's so much that we're missing. Mm-hmm. And when we're using psychedelics, we're really getting access to information that is not accessible in the day-to-day consciousness. I feel like you had a question and I kind of diverted it.
Oh, you did, because I was asking about, you know, what does it mean when you're talking about integrating neural networks? And I
answered your question.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, I do that sometimes.
What I hear is that, like, how our cognition goes offline when our trauma reaction is coming up, for example. And, you know, if you can have your cognition and your trauma information or material accessible, or, you know, you can experience the emotion and the memory without being flooded, things like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I want to spend just a couple of minutes, Laura, talking about the history of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, if that's okay.
Sure. So I think that'd be great.
In the 50s and 60s, there were a lot of studies that showed the efficacy of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy to treat a variety of conditions like alcoholism, depression, OCD, anxiety, and even end of life. So when, you know, people in hospice toward the end of their lives, there was a lot of research. And then, you know, and again, I don't want to get too much into it, but the government was concerned that people will have independent way of thinking. There was Vietnam War, and people started saying, hey, why should I go in there and fight? And it was like, that didn't align with what the government wanted people to do. So in the late 60s, beginning or early 70s, all these medicines, and I intentionally called them medicines, became illegal. So they became Schedule I drugs like heroin and methamphetamine and cocaine, even though there were hundreds and hundreds of studies that showed how effective these medicines are.
The government was studying it a lot.
The government was studying it too.
So they knew the good effects.
Oh, absolutely. They're studying it. It's really interesting. They're studying it from a slightly different perspective. So the CIA was actually studying, you know, LSD and how maybe it can be used in, you know, in certain war situations. But yeah, I can spend a lot of time talking about that. And I think
I'll just add to what you're saying, that there was definitely a racism and social control aspect to why these medicines were made illegal. And, you know, the recordings that have been released about President Nixon's private conversations in the White House,
yes,
very clearly illuminated, yeah, that it was an intentional effort to basically silence the counterculture movement that was anti-war, and also to create division between white and black people to prevent civil rights. So just let's put that out there. I mean, that's an important.
Yeah, absolutely.
It did cause a lot of harm to both of those efforts that were trying to really do something positive.
Right. And if your listeners want to learn more about this, I highly recommend Michael Pollan's This Is Your Mind on Plants. And this is
as opposed to this is your brain on drugs, which was President Nixon's campaign. So Michael Pollan wrote this book, This is Your Mind on Plants. And he talks a lot about what you just mentioned, Laura, all this racism. And he, you know, it brings some interviews with people who were Nixon's advisors and basically saying, this was not a coincidence. There was intention there.
Yeah. We're not anti-government conspiracy theorists. This is just history.
Oh, no. This is facts. This is based on facts. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I think we should kind of go back to the psychedelic effect and integration with the EMDR. So EMDR is an extremely effective psychotherapy. In my experience, I have not seen therapy that is more transformative. But even with EMDR, sometimes with certain clients, you get stuck in what the psychedelics do in this situation is really helping the client to get into outside of their normal state of consciousness. There are a lot of, and there's more and more research now about psychedelics, and I would say the cousin of psychedelics, MDMA. So MDMA is the active ingredient in a drug called ecstasy or Molly. But the pure drug itself is MDMA, and there are a lot of research. It's taking a long time for the FDA to approve it, but MDMA is actually considered breakthrough therapy when it comes to post-traumatic stress disorder. So what these medicines do is help the client to be outside of their normal state of consciousness, but as opposed to other medicines, like, you know, I'm thinking SSRI, like Prozac, or, you know, anti-anxiety medications, or any other psychopharmacological treatment, when we're taking these medicines, they're helping us during the time that they're in our system. But once we stop taking the medication, we stop taking Prozac, yeah, it's not helping you anymore.
It doesn't heal something inside. It just changes you while you're on it.
Exactly. And what you see with psychedelics is that they really have this ability to lead to what we call trait change as opposed to state change. And this is, again, another correlation that I see with the EMDR, because EMDR is this therapy that leads to trait change. People who do EMDR, and when EMDR done successfully, it leads to trait change. So it's not that all the problems are gone, but certain memories that were used to be traumatic or psychological turn into more objective or neutral memories.
That's so promising, is that it's not just like, you know, it's like if you drink a glass of wine or a beer when you want to feel a little bit more relaxed, it doesn't make you stay relaxed. But when you do these medicines or a treatment like EMDR, it makes real change in the brain.
Right. So one of the things that we're sometimes struggling with is to maintain this what we call dual attention, which is necessary for the success of EMDR. You need to be in the memory and you need to observe the memory at the same time. And again, some people's trauma, and when I say trauma, I mean also attachment wounds.
Those can be harder to get to because they're nonverbal. Right. So these would be more, even more accessible this way. Sorry to interrupt you.
Right. No. It's a really good point, because the nonverbal piece is a really, really important piece. But, and I'm going to get to it in a second, but I think that it's important to look at this dual attention and how can we help clients get into dual attention. So in EMDR therapy, the way I do it with low dose of ketamine, relatively low dose, people can really get into that state. Now, there are different approaches. It's kind of like a Wild West when it comes to psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy right now. There are all these organizations that provide training, and they develop protocols, and they don't always consistent with what, you know, so different organizations have different
beliefs about what works and what doesn't. I, you know, my guiding principle is always what's best for the client. So in the way I do it is, as opposed to giving a high dose of ketamine, which a lot of ketamine treatment for depression is done that way in injectable form, for example, intramuscular, I use sublingual. So people put it under the tongue, and again, a relatively low dose of sublingual ketamine. And while they're under the influence of ketamine, we're actually doing the EMDR work. Now, that is not possible if you're using higher doses, because in higher doses, ketamine has a more psychedelic effect. And when you use it in a lower dose, it's not getting so intense for the client. They can definitely feel it, but it's not to a point that they're kind of get lost in a psychedelic, in an intense psychedelic experience.
Okay. I mean, this is really helpful. I wanted to ask you just specifically like how you do it, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. So
yeah. No, I can talk more about specifics. I'm happy to talk about that. This is why we're talking. So usually I do somewhere between 3 and 4 hour sessions. So if you're doing psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, any form of, you know, psychedelic or using medicine, you can't do a 50-minute session. That's not realistic. So I usually spend 3 to 4 hours, and we're starting with clients laying on the floor. You know, I have a special mattress and a heavy blanket, and they put eye shades on, and we put music, and they spend the first hour relaxing. Let me backtrack for a second, because before we start that, we're talking about intentions. Intentions for the session are really important. And we talk about it in previous sessions too, you know, kind of like planning, but we're also setting the intention at the beginning of the session. Then we spend about an hour. Now, when I say about an hour, it can be 45 minutes, it can be an hour and a half, and sometimes it can be 2 hours. They're spending with just letting the medicine do what it does and listening to music and relaxing. And then the second part, which again, I would say about an hour, but it can be more, it can be less, we're doing EMDR reprocessing, which again, not possible with higher doses, but definitely possible with low doses of sublingual ketamine. And then when we're processing, a lot of times, this is where, you know, the magic of EMDR happens in the reprocessing phases. And I really love this work, because I see people getting into places that they cannot get into without these medicines. And so I'm happy to talk about that more in a minute, but just want to kind of talk about the structure. It's really important to do some integration. So I don't want to do processing and then, oh, we're out of time in the middle of processing. We need to take some time to get back, kind of talk about, first of all, what did we learn today? What are we taking from it? And then if we need to use some closing regulation techniques before the client goes back home, we do that too. There are a lot of things to cover.
Mm-hmm.
For example, clients are not driving to and from a psychedelic session. So ideally they get a ride. If they don't get a ride, they take Uber or Lyft, but definitely nobody drives. There is a separate informed consent form that they have to sign, because it is still kind of experimental treatment, at least, you know, according to the law. Again, I think that the people who are already using this treatment see how effective it is, but the FDA takes a little bit of time to regulate things. So I mentioned the processing, but it can be really any phase of EMDR. So phase two of EMDR is preparation, for example. Some clients are not able to connect with certain regulations. So we do a lot of resourcing in phase two. We're helping clients, you know, connect with, and again, this is very individual. Some clients can use yoga poses and some clients can use, think about spiritual figures, for example, or supportive figures or nurturing figures. And sometimes in the day-to-day consciousness, because of this, you know, reducing vault that I mentioned that Aldous Huxley was talking about, clients are not able to really access that. But when we are, when they are in that state, they're really able to feel it. And this is an understanding. You mentioned the nonverbal piece, Laura. This is a deeper understanding than our cognitive, logical understanding. And this is the real transformation. That's where real transformation happens. Michael Pollan used the word ineffable in his books to describe this experience that is really hard to put into words, but it's an experience. And it's a, again, it's a deeper level of understanding. You know, the Buddhists talk about non-dualism. So there's no separation of object and subject. There's no you and me. It's just seeing a larger picture of what is going on here. And people really get access to these states, which is really exciting. You know, we have these tools now. We have these medicines. I think that, you know, as much as we like to complain about, you know, modern times and, you know, how maybe it's not safe to walk down the street, I think being a therapist in 2023 is really exciting that we can do these things. It's kind of like a renaissance of these medicines, which, by the way, when you look at psilocybin, for example, it's been used for hundreds, if not thousands of years in certain cultures. We, in the West, we only know about it since, you know, 1955, 56, but it's been used in indigenous cultures as a medicine for many, many years. I think one of the problems that we're running into is research. So the gold standard of research is double-blind control studies. And this is something that you cannot do with psychedelics. You can't be double-blinded because, you know, double-blind means that both the, you know, the subject and the researcher don't know who took placebo and who took the medicine. And I think it becomes very, very clear who took the medicine after a relatively short period of time. So you can't do these studies using the gold standard of research. But I think that, and this is our arrogance as human beings that have this Western culture, that this is the only way that we're looking at things. If it doesn't match this, if it doesn't fit this model, then it's not valid or reliable. And this is not true. I mean, you just need to do it, to experiment and to really see that there's, it's working.
Agree. And I will say too that, you know, arrogance, you're right. It's a Eurocentric perspective that what science is, what is the gold standard, when people have, humans have done their own qualitative research for thousands of years with these medicines. And the, you know, the Eurocentric view is that's not real evidence, but.
Right. So luckily we do have some evidence because there's more. I mentioned Carhart Harris from the UK, who does a lot of research, and they're doing a lot of brain scans and they're using, you know, tools like functional MRI when people are under the influence of psychedelics. And what we see, and this is another correlation that we see changes in the default mode network of the brain. So the default mode network is kind of like a hub of where different networks are talking with each other. And it's being considered as the network of the self. So when you're not doing anything, when you're not involved in a cognitive task, let's say you're waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you're not doing anything, you're just thinking, you tend to think about yourself, about, we all have that. It's human nature, right? We're thinking about ourselves from our own perspective. And when we're involved in a cognitive task, this network, it's not one network, it's kind of like a network of networks, tends to slow down, to quiet down. So what we see both in EMDR or as a result of EMDR and psychedelics is that the default mode network quiets down. So it stops being, the world stops being about me and myself and my problems and my issues. We can see a bigger picture. I think another interesting correlation is that they both work top down and bottom up at the same place. So top down from the, you know, our cognitive brain to our emotional brain, our limbic system, and to the brainstem and to the body, and all the way down to our body. And up means from the body to the lower parts of the brain, to the limbic system, and to the cognitive brain. So it's a parallel process. It's not one or the other. And both the EMDR and psychedelics really activate these, both these mechanisms. And I think one more interesting correlation is also that therapy doesn't stop when the actual therapy session ended. So for example, when I do a psychedelic assisted psychotherapy and I'm trying to do it when I'm only doing EMDR without it, is to have the client reflect on things, because we're starting something in the brain. The brain, we're activating the brain, and these insights continue. They don't stop when the session ends. So when it comes to the psychedelic assisted EMDR therapy, I want my clients to clear the day after that. You're not doing it and going to work after, and you're not even making plans, you know, to go out with your friends. You take the time to reflect and journal and think about things, and maybe some of these insights will come later. Yeah, I think one more interesting correlation, Laura, is that we're getting into the unconscious with both. Mm-hmm. I think with EMDR therapy and with psychedelics, we're getting access to places that we don't usually get access in our mind. And I think that's the goal, right? Carl Jung said it, that until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. I think that it's important that we are getting into this unconscious material and then do something with it, process it. That's my personal bias as, you know, as an EMDR therapist and consultant.
I agree with you about that too. So this sounds exciting and promising. And yeah, I'm really encouraged about all of the different ways that people are bringing these medicines to healing trauma and really being intentional and, you know, using an integrative approach. Because, you know, it seems like from what I hear, when people have negative experiences with psychedelics, when they're trying to use it for healing purposes, the main issue is that lack of integration work.
Right. Right. Thank you for bringing it up, because I mentioned three parts to a session, right? We're starting with just calming and listening to music, and then we're doing processing, and then we do integration. Another thing that I do with my clients when we're doing these kind of sessions is that next week, even for clients that usually don't see me weekly, next week I want to see you, because I want to do another integration session, because there's the integration of, all right, we did processing and now we're integrating, but there's the integration of what happens next week, that, you know, what other insights did you have? And oftentimes people do. So I want to see them the following week after we're doing psychedelic assisted EMDR therapy.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's so valuable. And like what you said about when the session's over, the work isn't really over, because it's not like you just walk out of the office and boop, it's all turned off and you just go back to your life and, you know, do what you do. It's still, you know, landing and it's still working through. And as you move, it's moving
right
through your system and, you know, the insights and even like walking is bilateral processing, right? So
right.
Can bring be. That. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that a lot of times people have that ineffable, this experience that cannot be explained in words or language, but giving a little time can help integrate it into words or concepts, as opposed to, you know, during the therapy, during the integration, sometimes clients can't really explain everything.
Yeah.
It's a lot, you know, sometimes it's visual experiences. Sometimes it's very strong somatic experiences. Every client is different. That's the beauty of the work. This is part of the problem also with, you know, developing protocols for these therapies, because every client is different and every client will experience in a very, very different way. And I'm not completely against protocols, right? We need to have, like, for example, safety protocols, which, by the way, you know, underground guides who are not necessarily therapists, but have been doing this kind of work for decades, they have their protocols. You know, you're not having any sexual contact with your clients, but sometimes touch is actually beneficial. Now, this is where, you know, our licensing board might not be agreeing with that necessarily, right? Like, touching clients can be, you know, very sensitive subject. But a lot of psychedelic guides who've been doing this work see the benefit of holding the client hands when you know, when clients are going into, you know, these dark places and they need the support. And again, when someone is holding your hand, it's more than just saying words to you. It's they are there with you, supporting you on a physical level. So it's, we need to have protocols, we need to have safety protocols, but I think that we have, I don't know, in the world of EMDR, we have, I think, way too many protocols. And I think that I'm starting to see a similar trend in psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. So, you know, some therapists will only treat you if you do six of these extended sessions in like the span of 3 weeks or something. And like, first of all, who can afford it, right? How can we make it accessible? And second of all, it's just not realistic for some people. So
some people's nervous. I can't imagine my nervous system could handle doing six extended sessions in 2 weeks or six weeks even.
Yeah. It's a lot.
My nervous system, I feel overwhelmed just imagining that.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we need to think about how we make this treatment accessible to everyone. And that's part of the criticism on, you know, the protocols that were developed for MDMA treatment, again, which is in process. But right now, the protocol says two providers for, I think it's like 8 or 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So who would be able to pay for that? Two providers, 8 or 10 hours. Let's say they're not extremely expensive. It's still going to be an expense that most people cannot afford. So I think that that's another thing that we as the community of therapists need to think about. How are we making these treatments accessible to as many people as possible?
Yes. Yes. That's a great point. And I've also heard people say, I don't know how true this is because I don't know this from my own experience, but I've heard people on this podcast say that when MDMA is approved, that it's likely to be that the medicine, the pill, whatever brand has already put their patent on it, is going to be, I don't know what form, if it's a pill or liquid or whatever, but it's going to be
expensive itself for the medicine. That's just the medicine.
Yeah. So again, this is, I mean, I know I've done a lot of research on, you know, ketamine. So ketamine has been around since, I think it's 1962. So it's been around for a while. So there's no patent on regular ketamine. So now there's a nasal spray ketamine, and this is patented. So this is a lot more expensive, but this is also approved by some insurances. So yeah, things are getting interesting in that area. There's always going to be, you know, companies that are for profit. And I think there are already some patents when it comes to psilocybin, which is crazy because it's a mushroom that grows in the wild.
So maybe that's the one.
Yeah, has been used for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And there are already patents. And I don't know exactly how, but, you know, like with good lawyers and, you know, corporations can find ways to capitalize on that too. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's still, we know in the psychedelic assisted world, there's a lot of things that need to be addressed in terms of equity and the past criminalization. But yes, it's very, very exciting and promising. And I'm thrilled that you shared with us today about how you're doing this. And I agree with you too, that, you know, it's such a strange time to be a therapist. And I think being a trauma therapist, it's also an amazing time because we know so much more. And just what, you know, I hope I have 20, 30 more years in the field. What can develop? I mean, the way things have changed over the past 10 years has been amazing. And, you know, it's only going to be more. So hopefully, unless something else comes to squash it, like
what we were talking about. I think this is a really, really good and important point because things will probably happen like they did in the 60s, right? So there was a lot of research in universities. It's not, you know, just kind of like a shady research.
Right. It wasn't illicit.
There was a lot of research. It wasn't illicit until people started abusing it. And once any kind of drug becomes available, there will be people who will abuse it. And we need to think, again, us as a community, we need to think how to minimize that. And I think every therapist who uses these medicines needs to think about how we can not go there, how we can prevent that from happening, because that can be really, really hard. Because, you know, the media, and again, going back to Nixon, and the media will find one case and exaggerate the fear of what could potentially happen and ignore the other thousands of people who benefit from these medicines. So we really need to be mindful of that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And thank you for what you're doing in so many ways to help people heal from trauma and attachment wounds. There's so much need for healing, and you're spreading your message through all the training you're doing and through your book and hopefully other books that you'll write and courses and trainings and all that good stuff. So thank you, Rotem, for what you do and for talking about it with me here on Therapy Chat. I hope maybe we can talk again sometime in the future and see where things are then.
Yeah, I'm always happy to talk to you, Laura. And thank you for what you're doing. I have to say one more thing, that 2023 is an exciting time to be a therapist, not only because we know so much more and we have access to these technologies, but that we can do it together as a community. I know that you have, you know, a network of therapists that people don't have to feel alone when doing this work. I think it's so important that we have a group of people that we connect with. This changes everything for us, for the therapists. And if we're not connected with a community, then how can we be there in our best selves for our clients? So thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for saying that. And, you know, that's kind of like what I was thinking about. I know we have to stop, but just last thought that, you know, when you said what an exciting time it is to be a therapist, it is. And it's also a time when so many therapists are leaving the field. So many people are just exhausted, burned out, overwhelmed, feel like they can't do it anymore. And I deeply care about keeping people who have, you know, who care about this, keeping us being able to do this work, because it's not just that we need more therapists, but, you know, the knowledge that people have. Someone who's been in the field 10, 20 years and says, I can't do this anymore, I'm going to go and become I'm going to work in finance. I don't blame anybody for making a change, but it's like, don't give up hope. There is community. You have a free community for EMDR therapists. I have a membership paid community for trauma therapists, not EMDR therapists in particular, but just trauma therapists across the board. And there are other places where we can gather. And whether it's a community membership that you join, or just finding people in your local area, or even online friends who you can relate to. We need that. We need that. Our relational connection and communalism is such an important aspect of being well as a therapist, to be able to do the work that we do with clients.
Absolutely. With that, we, I think, are not paying enough attention to, because we're, again, going back to our Western American model of like everyone for themselves. But I think there's such an important role to be in a community. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you and I are in community together now. And I'm looking forward to the next time we talk, and tell people where they can find all these amazing things that you're doing.
So if people want to learn about EMDR, so for EMDR therapists, a community only for trained EMDR therapists. If you're in, during the training, we let people join. It's emdr-learning.com, or you can just Google the EMDR learning community and join. It's free. We have amazing events, really good speakers. I'm really trying to bring the best speakers in the field of EMDR. EMDR Denver, it's emdr-denver.com. And this is where we do our treatments here in Denver with my business partner, Sarah Severino. And then The Art and Science of EMDR is my book, and also the name of my website. If people go to the website, they can actually learn more about, there are a lot of interviews that I did with experts in the field. And if people want to learn about the book, I made chapter 5, which is EMDR and mindfulness, available for a free download on the website, on the book page. So people could download that chapter. I think that's it.
Awesome. I'll put all those links in the show notes. And Rotem, thank you again for sharing your time with me today.
Thank you, Laura.
Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Regan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.